Well, it is a momentous day with the passing of Graham. We're going to deal with him as a subject later on, but it was just sort of like intersection today when I was sitting at my desk and I read that he had died. I said, well, we're talking about the greatest evangelist until Billy Graham tonight and the end of his life tonight, in history tonight. And we have Billy Graham's death announced today. So he died yesterday, I guess. So there's a lot of controversy around Graham, and we'll try to unravel some of that when we get to it, all the way from he's not a believer to whatever. So on there's Cliff Barrows, and he was the song director for the Crusades, and he was kind of my model for a song director. He did it with his whole body. And then there's George Beverly Shea, who sang, I'd rather have Jesus than wealth or fame. Okay, we can't do it. There were others, but those are the ones that were on the platform most of the time, and then Graham came in. So, controversial person. I'll just tell you that it'd be a good example for you guys who are going to teach covenant theology or against covenant theology, is that Billy Graham was a fundamentalist, and when he married his wife was from a Presbyterian church. His father was named Nelson Bell, and he took on her father's, Mr. Bell's, theologies to some extent, or took his advice. So you have covenantalism creeping into his fundamentalism. And then, I don't know, I think somebody was telling me before that even at the end of his life, he became a universalist. So my argument is, once you start down the road, what is going to stop you from going clear off the end of the bridge? It's because there's nothing to stop you anymore, because what the device you use to get you off the road is the same device you'll use at the end of the road to set aside all the scripture. You just do it by, you know, small bites or big bites. So it explains him a little bit how he ended up where he is, so where he was. But now he's in heaven, and the Lord, supposing that's true, the Lord will welcome him in, and the theology is no longer a problem for him. We are 14th lesson of our Great Awakening series. We are coming to an end of a section that's kind of a seam in the story line. From here we go into, let me go through these panels here. From here we go into the early American pre-revolutionary times of the awakenings of France, enlightenments of France, French Revolution, and somewhat the Enlightenment in America, which is a different one. We'll want to talk a little bit about the Christian influence, especially evangelical influence in that. And into early America, and then at that point, we start picking up the Second Great Awakening, and that'll be around 1800. So we'll do that. These that are in yellow. See, a week or two of the American and French Revolutions and the probable contributions of the First Awakening and the American on American independence. A lot of controversy about that. Not everybody's going to agree on that one. A lesson on early American religion and then Christian influence in the Western world as we got it then into the 19th century. So that's kind of where we're going. Billy Graham, you see his way down here on the list. So he's on my list. I put these resources up. I still think they're the best, especially Delamore's two-volume set. I think I have three sections tonight that I want to talk about. Hopefully, we'll get through all of them. I want to talk a little bit about the Methodist. How many of you have a Methodist background? Two? Three? Four? Okay. Baptist. See, that's the other one that would be a large number. Catholic. A few Catholics. Not very many. Catholic's been a great, you know, harvest field, because with the Methodists, you have to argue that this is the Bible. With the Catholics, you don't have to argue that point. You know, so you're leg up with a Catholic person because you don't have to explain that to them. But the Methodist says, So what you have here is Francis Asbury. Now, we know about that name because there's an Asbury Seminary. It's a Methodist seminary. He was, during his 45-year ministry in America, traveled on horseback on a carriage an estimated 300,000 miles, delivering some 16,000 sermons. He was so well-known in America that letters addressed to Bishop Asbury United States of America were delivered to him. So can you imagine the post office doing that today? In fact, they don't even forward the mail to the next neighbor. He's got to take it back to Omaha and then bring it back out again. Pretty much, 45 years out planting churches. No, he was out there. He was a church planter. Yep. So what we have in the diagram here is the dark shaded spots are the counties that had more than 25 churches. So you can see they're up in upper eastern coastline is where they were greatest, and then you go to the west. By the way, this is 1850, only 100 years from where we are at Whitfield, 100 years later when there were none, you know, to 100 years later where there are these thousands of Methodist churches. In fact, if you ever see an old Western, cowboys, you know, the church in town probably is a Methodist church, you know, and the way they portray still is. if it hasn't been torn down or made into something else already, but yeah, the Western frontier had the Methodist churches. So anyway, you know, I regret a little bit, not a little bit, I regret quite a bit that there wasn't a more clear presentation of the gospel with these people. They get mixed up with this kind of stuff here, a phenomenon, the second work of grace. Wesley, I don't want to say came up with it, you might almost say he did, and it was perpetrated into the Methodist churches. And this went out into the frontier of America, and I'm sure there were many that were saved people that were doing this, especially in the South. In fact, even today, there are those that are in the Southern Methodist churches are still more conservative than the ones in the North. So a little bit about the Methodist here, a few panels of this. The strength of the Methodist work in the colonies, John Wesley sent two lay preachers, Richard Brogman and Joseph Fillmore, to America in 1769. Now we're within a year of Whitfield's life, or end of his life. So it's the end of his life. And I just showed you the graph of the 100 years growth of the churches in America. 2 years later, Richard Wright and Francis Asbury were dispatched to undergird the growing American Methodist societies. Asbury became the most important figure in early American Methodism. His energetic devotion to the principles of Wesleyan theology, ministry, and organization shaped Methodism in America in ways unmatched by any other individual. Now, with the American Revolution, remember we have England and America are still under one king, but the American Revolution changed that, so we got a church that's sort of spanning two continents and are going to end up being subject in the possibility of two countries. So the American Revolution profoundly impacted Methodism. John Wesley's loyalty to the king and his writings against the revolutionary cause did not enhance the image of Methodism among many who supported independence because it was an English-based church or English-based people. Moreover, a number of Methodist preachers refused to bear arms to aid the Patriots, so they looked like they were just not going to join in the revolution. But when independence from England was won, Wesley recognized that changes were necessary for American Methodism to survive. So he sent Thomas Cook, to America to superintend the work with Asbury. Cook brought with him a prayer book entitled The Sunday Service of the Methodist in North America, changed the name, prepared by Wesley and incorporated his revisions of the Church of England's 39 Articles of Religion. So we take the English one and revised it and put the American name on it. Okay, got it. So Richard Watcott and Thomas Wesley, whom Wesley had ordained, now that's a new one, he took steps to ordain ministers by himself, not the Church of England. When he did that, Wesley's ordination set a precedent that ultimately permitted Methodists in America to become an independent church, cut out of the Church of England. I never really thought about the Methodists being former Episcopalians. You know, the Episcopalians are the Church of England in America. I never associated those together enough until now. Now I know better. So really, the Methodist Church really comes out of the Church of England. Well, just for a full scope here, Two other churches or denominations were formed in America, which in the earliest years were composed almost entirely of German-speaking people. The first was founded by Philip William Oderbein and Martin Born, or Bain, however you'd say his name. Oderbein, a German Reformed pastor, and Bain, a Mennonite, preached an evangelical message similar to the Methodist. So they're forming churches. In 1800, their followers, these two groups, formally organized into the church called United Brethren of Christ. Okay, so the brethren probably came from the Mennonites because they were Anabaptists tend to call themselves brethren. A second church, the Evangelical Association, was begun by Jacob Albright. Albright, a Lutheran farmer, a tile maker in eastern Pennsylvania, was converted by the United Brethren and nurtured in a Methodist class meeting. He later established his own connection of preachers better to reach his fellow German speakers. The Evangelical Association was officially organized in 1803. So this is how it ends up. Now we have the Church of England. I don't have my marker, I forgot that. Well, you have to watch this. Church of England, and then we have the Methodists that come out of this, let's say 1773, some date like that. And they continue on through. And in the meantime, we have these other groups that are formed that have their own basis, but they're enough alike that they join. And then in 1946, in our lifetime, a lot of ours lifetime, they joined, and then both of them as a group joined the United Methodist. So we'd have the United Brethren, the EUB churches we used to have. So anybody have a United Brethren background? EUB. EUB. There was one in York, and I remember as a young men's chorus, we did go there one night and Saturday night or Sunday night to sing for them. So there was a EUB church in York. Now, I don't think they're EUBs anymore. They're all Methodist churches. Okay. Isn't that interesting for those that have Methodist background? Now, this is going to be interesting. I think about what I tell you, it's going to be interesting. I don't know whether you think it's interesting or not. It's exciting, you know, like, all right, what I was going to say or try to say was when you study church history, it isn't just study church history. You have to involve yourself in the theology, and I love to study the theology in the context of church history. So we're going to deal with a big, whatever, explosive issue in church history that we still deal with today. So I have that stuff up on the board. That has has everything to do with today as much as it did everything to do in those back days. So we're going to talk about the phenomenal stuff, and I could not find the right word that they used all the time. It wasn't a word that we used about this. But phenomenal is that which is sort of different. You just kind of like, what do I have here? They're things that you don't expect. Later I'm going to talk about normal or abnormal things. So phenomenal is those things that surprise us. So the phenomenal would have to do with, talking about worship services now where people assemble together, where preaching goes on. We have interruptions, disturbances, loud voices. We have crying, wailing, flailing, falling, fainting, collapsing, screeching, and super strength. These are phenomenal events, okay? So these all happen in the ministry of Whitfield and Wesley and to some extent even Jonathan Edwards. And we want to talk about that and try to make some sense out of it. Now, I say phenomenal. It's difficult of the issues to decipher because they're experiences. Experiences are always tough. So phenomenal is the remarkable, exceptional, extraordinary, amazing, astonishing, astounding, sensational, stunning, incredible, unbelievable, marvelous, magnificent, wonderful, outstanding, singular, out of the ordinary, unusual, unprecedented, then for the informal, fantastic, terrific, tremendous, stupendous, awesome, out of this world, and in a literary sense, wondrous. And on the point of the phenomenal is where the awakenings get attacked. So what is predictable? Well, this lady sits on the couch and says, she says, our lives are so predictable. And he says, I knew you were going to say that. So perhaps the question is even larger than the phenomenal. Reaching down to our time, in our time we would have the old word Pentecostals, the new word, the charismatics, from phenomenal experiences. I gave you the list. Now, there are norms that are acceptable culturally and even religiously. And I do appreciate norms, because in your classroom, you sit down and generally are quiet and you laugh at the appropriate spot. That's very normal. So certain behaviors are considered normal when they are common and is predictable. What is normal is what we have seen before. When one cries fire as a warning, we say that is a normal response. But when someone cries fire when there is none, we say that's not normal. And we could go on and on. So normal is what is expected given a certain set of circumstances. These norms also live in our religious communities. If you visit a Catholic church service as an observer, you will not do the normal things like genuflect or stand at the given place in the service. We never did. We always stayed seated. Of course, you are a visitor, so a lack of participation is also considered normal for visitors. Evangelicals have their normals to be observed. No conversation during the services, a quiet demeanor is expected and promoted as normal. And so in the preaching of Whitfield and the Wesleys, it was normal to preach inside the church, where Wesley thought that God could only, the only place where God could save. That's kind of funny, wasn't it? God outside, God can save out here? I mean, he was so attached to the church. But as they were forced out into the open air preaching, the abnormal became normal. And as the churches could not hold the church, the crowds that came. Well, with the preaching of the new birth, another issue became prominent, a phenomenal response. A preaching of the new birth brings a phenomenal response to the message, and by some considered abnormal. We've got to swat down the abnormal, right? Rather than normal stately congregations, like in the Church of England, there are interruptions of activity, loud crying, and I went through this, wailing, a physical falling, fainting, collapsing, a general commotion, a general disruption in the preaching that became a distraction during the preaching. Now, a couple weeks ago, I saw this cartoon, and somebody analyzed it, and I thought it would be fun to do, but it's a satire here, and it's actually sarcasm. And there, you can look at various things. You got demons and ghosts flying around. You got women laying down. You got, it looks like a guy making love to his wife there, or I hope it's his wife, or maybe not. And so we have all this going on while Whitfield is preaching, and we got guys looking in the windows. We got demons flying overhead. So this is the typical portrayal of the awakening meeting. Very phenomenal. So this drawing I showed you is made in 18th century publication by William Hogarth, which ridiculed the ministry of George Whitfield. Prominently featured is a woman who had fallen due to an experience of God's power, and emotionalism in Hogarth's mind. That's a comment he makes. I didn't write this. Whitfield saw this happen many times, such as on July 11, 1742, Whitfield spoke to a crowd of around 20,000 in Scotland. And that day during the service, people wept over the sins and some fell prostrate. Now, we have the task here in the 21st century to determine what is normal in the biblical confines, thus acceptable, and what is abnormal and thus not acceptable. In our quest to determine what is normal, we now acknowledge the factors, some factors here on the board, that the unpredictability of the human heart, may be called the nature, as human nature, as fallen nature. And the question of the phenomenal, the intrusion into our world from the paranormal world, that which springs from the spirit world, and there we have two sources. We have the demonic, the angelic and the demonic, so with angels, both, you know, they can be targeted as the source for these events. So it actually has three things: the human himself, the two different entities from the spirit world. Again, this satire in a drawing points to all of these responses. The human in the spirit world responses, the human in the spirit world and the spirit world responses. From an untrained eye, it is hard to differentiate between them. I looked at this, and I think we finally have a sheep and a goat here. It looks like a lady holding a Bible, but I think it's really a sheep. And then the goat's on the other side. And then we have the demonic flying overhead and puffing these ideas into Whitfield's mind. So they would say this is not normal. So it's ridicule. Now, since there are many moving parts, and by the way, we have the Bible in our background. We know that in Acts chapter 2, the The Spirit fell on the people in the upper room as if tongues of fire on each of them. They stood there. And then we have Jesus casting out demons, and they ran into hogs, and they fled into the Sea of Galilee. So we have these phenomenal events in the Bible, and I could go on with many things that Jesus talks about or are recorded in the Gospels. Since there are many moving parts, possibilities or combination thereof, it would be difficult to set out perfect judgment on all of these events in the Great Awakening. Christians are well aware of the angelic world and the world of the demonic. We have glimpses of this in the life of Jesus and in rare places in the life of the Old Testament prophets. Not a lot. If you think about it, there's a lot. There are not a lot. Very, very rare. Think about the time, over the time which the New Testament, Old Testament was written. Jesus establishes authority over the spirit world in his earthly ministry, and I think that's what's going on with the hogs, for example, and other superintendents over the demonic world. He can send them where he wants them to go, and they obey. So I have a question a little bit about this in the Great Awakening. Is the surfacing of the spirits in the Great Awakening replicated in the Great Awakening like it was during Jesus' time? Now, we know why they came to the service during Jesus' time, because it would show the power that Jesus had over the spirit world. Okay, once that's been established, there's no need to go back and restate that. So if this is happening again, why so? And I don't know that I have a question for answer for that question, because we have no instruction given to the church to deal with the issues in the spirit world except to not acknowledge them. You're aware they're there. It doesn't say how to deal with them. It doesn't say how to get rid of them or how to minimize their effect or to avoid them. None of that. It's just that we recognize there are spirits in the world, and they're good spirits and bad spirits, and that's kind of where it's left. But in our understanding of phenomenal, our church, we believe that the gifts, the supernatural sign gifts, have ceased. So in our standing of the phenomenal, the cessation of spirit sign gifts, we cannot assign phenomenal to the good spirits. You know, we don't go back and say, well, those are the good spirits doing that. Or if today, we can't say there's a good spirit doing it today. We cannot assign the phenomenal to the good spirits and are equally reluctant to assign phenomenal to the demonic. You know, I've been in ministry since 1973, full time. And there's probably one or two times that I was involved in a situation where I say, I wonder if there's not a demon involved in this issue. But it was very, very rare. And I surely couldn't tell for sure in those times whether there was a demonic involvement. It's just that there are certain times get to a point where you just can't explain things. The things are so abnormal that you resort to that as a possibility. But you can't really do much with it because the scripture doesn't give us any help. So we are left then with the phenomenal attributed to the human condition. It is the falseness of the heart leaning towards deception and dishonesty, or psychological, or whatever that is, or the physiological realm that now we maybe can have to deal with. Now let's going back to the phenomenal, a little bit of history, or current history. We lived in Topeka, Kansas. And on 6th Street, just west of downtown, was a place where the modern charismatic event began. It's also another place associated with Los Angeles, the Azusa Street Church, which you have a picture of here, is where they usually say it started. But in all honesty, in all truthfulness, it really started as a manifestation first in Topeka, Kansas, on 6th Street, and when we lived there, I drove by the place. I don't know whether the church stands there yet or not. All right, so churches, that is denominations, are formed along these lines, how you decide this phenomenon, what it is. Since 1905 or 1906, Topeka, Kansas, 1905, Azusa, California, 1906, the Christian community has recognized a fracture zone between those who accept the phenomenal as a Christian normal and those who do not. Both sides have calcified to the point that it is difficult to have a meaningful discussion. I mean, they both have set in their way. Their theology, that is, by those who see the phenomenal as normal, this group finds themselves having to defend the laughing and the barking revivals that came out of Toronto and out of Florida. Some of the most weirdest things you ever can imagine happened out of that group. So they're in the side, have to defend that. And the cessationists, who have a hard time dealing with the subject of phenomenal at the 20th and 21st centuries, as we will have with the Great Awakening. I'm going to come away and say, I don't know. You know, that's probably not a bad answer, but at least I'm going to have to find, you know, explain something that the what's so abnormal barking animals revivals. So with that, we begin a little bit of a short analysis of phenomenal in the First Great Awakening. Dallimore's book has a great chapter on the subject, and I recommend it to you. I don't know that anybody will ever read it, but at least in my notes, chapter 19, volume 1. Okay, the phenomenon has always been observed in church history. Maybe not all the time, everywhere, forever, but it's always been around. We say that just to alert us to the fact that what is happening in the awakenings is not new in the 18th century. But our focus will be on that short time, 35 years, of Edwards and Whitfield and the Wesleys. There were others. In fact, I should have sometime, this is my last lesson on the series, but I should bring you a list of other names of evangelists. There were a lot of evangelists. Some were quite known, quite well known. Some were very effective. All right. So there were others than these three. At the time of Edwards, let's say start 1735, is when he had his first revival or first awakening, to Whitfield, which started 39 or 40. Now we have to include the Wesleys from about 1740 on to the end of Whitfield's life, 1770. We have 35 years. That's the period we're going to look at. Edward notes, Jonathan Edwards notes, Northampton in Massachusetts, notes the strong emotional effects on people who were occasioned by a sense of sin, having a fear of its consequences, and also the joy of their salvation. Now, John Wesley depended on the phenomenal events to confirm his ministry. Edwards did not. It is in this ministry where most, it is in his ministry, Wesley's ministry, where most of the over-the-edge experiences occurred. Now, partly or wholly. I mean, some, it's hard to say, because what happens now, you have people move from one group to the other group, and they did something under John Wesley to do the same thing under Whitfield, although Whitfield did not encourage it. John Wesley had. So was what happened under Whitfield attributable to Whitfield, or was it attributable to John Wesley? You see the mixing up we have here? So we know that John Wesley encouraged it. In fact, he almost primed the pump. Get it going. None of you out there having any feelings about this? You know, it's sort of like, yet Charles Wesley, his brother, was not so strong in the support of this, especially towards the end. He got more theologically correct than his brother did. Okay, Whitfield. While there were some phenomenal events in his ministry, he did not encourage them, even discourage them, to a denial of interruptions they caused. In other words, there's a cause of an interruption while he's preaching. He would stop and have them, you know, quit doing it or have the people removed, whatever it would take. According to Dallimore, all of the excesses, the over-the-edge phenomenal happenings, were traceable to John Wesley, even those who sat under Whitfield later, as I mentioned a minute ago. That shows how the phenomenal, normal phenomenal, was observable in all the ministries. Most of them were traceable to Wesley's experience-based Christianity. Can't get rid of it once you have it. Now, there are also personal reactions to preaching the new birth. I'm going to assume that that always was involved in it. You know, obviously every word wasn't necessarily on the new birth, but the preaching was preaching towards the new birth. So we have, first of all, normal reactions to the preaching of the new birth. And you, maybe some of you will identify some with some of this. I hope so. So the normal reaction number one would be a reaction to a sense of sinfulness, a sense of lostness, a realization of being hell deserving, despairing, hopelessness, fearful, panic ridden, sorrow, remorse, agony of soul, seeking pardon, forgiveness, contrition, maybe repentance even, regret, fear of being lost beyond hope, and a gripping fear of hell and of being cast into it. Those are not abnormal, because that's a reality. Now we have normal reaction number two. The physical reactions that come with these convictions are normal when God lifts the curtain, kind of like this, lifts the curtain to give you a glimpse of the spiritual state. And I think this is something I've thought about kind of fresh in my study. Says, you know, if an unbeliever could only be shown where he's going, it would scare him to death. I don't say it necessarily would save him, but that's something he doesn't have a perception of. He thinks everything's going to go on like it always has been. So what God may be doing in his revival is letting some of the people look into hell, so to speak, and it scares them to death. All right, so a physical reaction to what that reaction that comes from these convictions are normal when God lifts the curtain to give glimpses of the spiritual state. Maybe they don't have to look into hell to do this. Just look at their own heart. So physical reactions in this state of awareness may be in the extreme, but will not be destructive of self or others. It doesn't seem like it goes that far. There is maybe a total collapse, weeping and crying, and almost a groaning and agony. And I have said this. I'm not an evangelist. I've not seen a lot of people saved or been in the presence where they've been saved. Maybe a couple of dozen over the years, and they mostly come from middle America, stable families. They're not off, you know, having lived the life of wantonness and coming back as the prodigal son would, where you would have this kind of emotion when they finally have struggled and struggled, as we've seen Whitfield and we saw Wesley and Martin Luther struggle with these issues. And finally, when there's a breakthrough, they have this overwhelming damn break of emotion. I've not seen a lot of that, although I've seen tears, all right? I've said my own. All right, so we have the physical reaction in the state of awareness may be the extreme, but it will not be destructive of others. I mean, they're not out, you know, throwing stuff. There may be a collapse from exhaustion, but no supernatural empowerment or physical progress or intrusions, possession or intrusions. On the other hand, the abnormal reaction, largely the same. We have the sinfulness, the lostness, the hell-deserving, you know, have all the same understanding, but the reaction of it is different. In the extremes, rather than seeing an escape through the work of Christ, they see themselves bound to the demonic or Satan, and a war over the soul ensues that they believe they cannot win. Now that would put you in fear. There seems to be a tug of war to retain the soul as bound to Satan. There's no victory, but there's great fear and despair. That's also an abnormal reaction, but in a sense, a normal reaction, you'd think. So the abnormal reactions now are largely to the extreme. So explaining the physical phenomena is guesswork, but the physical pounding of the body to the ground, the extra strength exhibited, the danger caused to life, property, and seemed to be a pathetic way of showing the displeasure of the demonic side when the gospel threatens to make claims on the lost. So if this is what the demons are doing in response to the gospel, that's not what you see when God's at work. So it's from the demonic side we see these abnormal reactions. I call them abnormal. So thus far, it is biblically reasonable to accept that we have described as normal the reaction to a reality just discovered. The work of the Holy Spirit's empowerment via the preaching of the new birth. Ta-da, that opens eyes. But there's nothing more for us to observe. We can't judge each one of these definitively. So the reaction of the lost, the reaction of those of the lost to remain lost is reasonable. The reaction of those who are lost and remain lost is reasonable. They're terrified, considering the terrors of hellfire. The reaction of the lost who become saved is also reasonable, say normal, when considering the near-death experience of seeing into hell, so to speak, a joy unspeakable, full of mercy, and that's how we sing our songs. Take a breath. Shift in gears. Now, with this going on, with new lights and old lights, there's a reaction against this. The new lights, it's a reaction against the new lights. As one expect, that's what they call them, as one would expect, the phenomenal experiences in the shadows of the new light preachers, Edwards Whitfield, were lumped into Wesley's, and it was opposed by the old school or the so-called old light Presbyterians and congregationalists, and of course the Church of England. The old lights opposed the new lights, rejecting new birth preaching. That's what they were really rejecting. And with that, they came the disdain for their emotional responses by the subject. They wanted to satire those, that nothing reasonable here, it's just weird, don't even go to those meetings, you know, whatever. So the new light, just to explain the new light, old light. The new light and old light designation is opposite of how we think of the terms today. We say that anything is new is likely wrong, right? And we need to keep to the old story, not looking for a new one. That's how we think of it, but that's backwards from that day. But in the context of the Great Awakening, the new lights were actually returning to the older light, the oldest light, but for the entrenched churches that had sagged in their devotion to a world, to the Word, their old lights were no longer lights at all, but they became dark lights. Okay, now we said that we had a phenomenal, we said earlier that phenomenal does not appear here in the early 18th century and then disappear. It stays on. It has been around since early church and continues into the Great Awakening, 1800s. So we have covered the two reactions somewhat, a little bit. We've got to do one more, and that is on the human side. This layered cake, I call it, is one more layer to be addressed. And the factor of the unpredictability of the human heart. Can you predict it? Let's try that down in Florida. It just can't be done. Anybody thinks you can do it is going to run into trouble because they'll make a bigger mess of it than they had before. So, again, we are going to guess a little bit in this arena, so we are not able to assign 100% accuracy to the activity of the human factor in the expression of the phenomena. But our guess is that the phenomena was at first limited to the first two categories, the conviction categories, then the response by the believers that end up being believers, and those that were not believers. Those two reactions, leave those there. Now we got something else. But as a phenomena was observed by the uninvolved, unconvicted. So we have these that come, they come for the show, okay? There were personal reasons to feign the same phenomenal experiences. We got our beetle over here feigning death. But he's really not dead. So we have this going on in this arena. It is true that few of us, I think, in this room would want that kind of visible situation. We'd probably like to hide somewhere. But there are always some who bask in the attention given them. So volume 1 of chapter 19, Dollimore talks about this very category. Now, surprisingly, this category is the easiest to isolate and debunk, and which is what we need to do, okay? If the experience event can be commanded to be stopped, it is likely of human deception variety. If I call and say, stop that, and they stop, probably they're doing it, you know, for whatever reason. Dollimore says that those who disrupted in this way had also been in Wesley's meeting. We talked about that. He cites people who collapse and demand to be carried out. Whitfield's ushers, they didn't call them that, would carry them out, leave them at the door, and when that was done, the entertainer would get up and walk away. So obviously we got a feigning person here. And this was pretty easy to do. You know, if they, you know, whatever. A lot of that going on. So another evangelist, Chenick, one of the guys we could have talked about, had some difficulties, but he's one of the evangelists, reported the appearance of John Wesley preaching that the same people appeared again and again for deliverance. They'll get delivered again and again. Every week they come for deliverance. And with each appearance, their condition became worse. Something wrong, right? So remembering that John Wesley encouraged these reactions as affirmation of his ministry. And when he left the area, the phenomenon disappeared. So you see it's pretty much driven by the human deceptive heart. Now, as the years go by, the phenomenal ideas, activities die off, but what is retained in the Methodist are his doctrines of perfectibility and perfection. This is a product of a second grace, the second one after salvation, which, accordingly, ought to be sought by all. So this second work of grace will be picked up by the Keswick theology in Keswick, England, 1850, 100 years from our time we're talking about, in the Second Great Awakening with Charles Finney. So this two-step salvation, or sometimes called entire sanctification, comes in three forms. And this gets pretty close to home here. The first one, charismatic, the tongue speaking, there's instant sanctification. In other words, if you're not spoken in tongues, you're not really have all of what God has. But when you do, instantly you have it. Say, so it's instant sanctification. Follow that their trail very well and see it, but that's what's promised. Then we have the holiness churches. I call these the dry charismatics. They don't speak in tongues, but they have another work that doesn't manifest itself in tongues. But it is an event of full surrender. And they preach towards this second step. So that you've been saved. I've been to many services as a kid that preached for salvation. And then for those that are saved, dedicate your life to Christ. So there were the two steps that were really Keswick in their roots. So that comes out of the holiness churches where you get full surrender. And then Wesley went so far as to even say sinless perfection as the angels. And it was pretty hard to maintain. But so they had to redefine some terms. Now it comes to our turn, the lordship surrender approaching holiness teaching, sometimes just called the lordship issue, and I think that it's been misnomered. I mean, the other side is the one that should teach the lordship issue because it's the lordship that they're seeking. They're saved by grace, by Jesus, but they've not made him Lord of their life. So there's the second step you need to make, just like the holiness churches expected holiness of the person at a point in time. So those that do not believe that Jesus is the Lord at salvation, you have to receive him as Lord later, really, I think, becomes a lordship issue. All right, so we have it right close to us, and one of our battles we fought over the years has been over that issue. So we have the charismatic, the holiness churches, and then the lordship issue, surrender approaching holiness teaching. Now, this is a two-step salvation. It's not far from us who hold to a dispensational theology. Thank you, Dallas Seminary, whose founder had Presbyterian Keswick roots. And some of you have been in my classes, and Lewis Berry Schaefer's book on grace shows, I've showed you the footnotes in the book, and said that he says one thing here and an opposite thing here. And no wonder everybody that comes out of Dallas quotes Schaefer, because if you like him, you quote that part. If you don't like that part, you like it, you quote this part. So we have, when Hank Ferris was here, he's a late graduate of Dallas Seminary, he said that the student body is divided about half and half over this issue. And then it should not have needed to be. But so we have this issue real close to our hearts, even though we're not charismatic. But it's still a second step, which we teach against. You get it all when you get saved. I wanted to go through every one of the seven trips. Maybe I'll do it real quickly. Seven trips to show you what happened. The first one, he made a voyage to Georgia, and he kind of looked the place over. The second one, he came back, and he went there with a more determined idea of what he wanted to do there. At this time, he establishes the Bethesda Orphanage Messages. He preaches in New England. He meets Jonathan Edwards. Wesley publishes against predestination. His movement back in England is damaged, so he publishes against Wesley. Again, this is during this time. He marries Elizabeth and preaches in Scotland and made peace with John Wesley. That's the second, the second trip and the aftermath until the third trip, or the next trip. So on the third trip, he takes his wife with him. He arrives in poor health. He goes to Bermuda without his wife. Somehow they get separated. He goes from Bermuda to England, and she stays in Georgia. So she comes from Georgia. It was wintertime, so she couldn't sail. So she waited a whole year to be joined up again with him. So that's on the third one. They were separated by geography. And George Whitfield built for her a brick house in London, and they were united in 49. All right. Fourth trip, a short trip. There was trouble back in England, so he head home quickly. And then we have the fifth trip, where he spends a lot of time with Franklin. There's a lot of interesting discussion with Franklin. You can read his letters. And he was presenting the gospel or the challenge to Franklin right along as he wrote. So it wasn't like he was just a secular friend. He was actually approaching him as a believer would approach. Sixth trip. To America. He was ill before he left. He was ill when he got here. And he travels north and south along the East Coast, lasts a year and a three quarters. And this is where Whitfield tells Wesley to start sending missionaries to America to establish these churches. So it's on the sixth trip that happens. And it's at this time that Elizabeth dies after a short illness. Now, the last trip. He weathers winters in Georgia and he heads north and his condition is worn out. I don't want to go over this because I want to go in the end here. He ends up north where he dies. All right, so that's the last one. So I think I have time to do this. Final days of Whitfield. What we have here is a map of Massachusetts, and what's marked in red is where he is, and he's going to move down a little bit where he will die, and I'll show that to you. Okay, now we're talking September 1770. He dies September 30. During September, while he was in Boston, he was taken in the night with a violent lax attended with reaching and shivering. I have no idea what those medical terms mean. but it don't sound good. Within 2 or 3 days, he was on his way again, intending to extend his ministry still further northward into Canada. After preaching for a week in Portland, Maine, where Whitfield was again forced to recognize that he was too sick to proceed to Canada. So he turned southward and once again to the long journey to Georgia. The date is Saturday, September 29, 1770. By noon of that day, he had reached the town of Exeter, New Hampshire. He had not planned to preach there, but in arriving, found he could not refrain from doing so. A platform had been erected, and a large company of people had gathered, waiting to hear him preach. One observer noted to Whitfield, said, "Sir, you are more fit to go to bed than to preach." To which Whitfield replied, "If I had not yet finished my course, let me go speak once more in the fields, seal the truth, and come home and die." As Mr. Whitfield stood to speak, he remained fixed for several minutes, unable to speak, finally did, beginning his comments, saying, "I am certain he will assist me once more to speak in his name." He then perhaps delivered his best sermon. He declared, "I go to rest prepared. My sun has risen, and by aid from heaven has given light to many. It is now about to set. No, it is about to rise to the zenith of immortal glory." And he concludes, "My body fails, my spirit expands. How willingly would I live to preach Christ, but I die to be with him." This message was 2 hours in length. Following the message, he continued his journey of 50 miles to Newburyport, Massachusetts. And I show you the route, generally. So in Newburyport, Massachusetts, we have a picture of the manse and the church. The church was founded by Whitfield, and I mean by that is that the people that were won to the Lord by him organized churches, because I don't know that Whitfield ever organized churches. I never read that he did. So the church was founded by Whitfield's preaching, and the first pastor was Jonathan Parsons. Nice name for a pastor, I think. He was the overnight host for the Whitfield on his expected continuance to Georgia. The date is September 29, 1770. So we see the picture of the church and the manse is shown in the foreground. Well, after supper, Mr. Whitfield was asked how he felt, and he said he was tired, he would like to go to bed. But a crowd had gathered at the manse door to hear him preach. Wherever he went, the crowds gathered. I mean, you just can't imagine that happening anywhere today, that anybody wants to go hear a preacher. I mean, it's just so different. And he, like a good preacher he was, he says, "I'd never deny somebody wants me to hear me preach. Not hear me preach, but hear what I'm going to preach." So the crowd gathered at the manse door to hear him preach. Whitfield, unwilling, despite his weariness, to forego opportunity to preach the gospel, stood on the landing halfway up the stairs. So I'm assuming that these windows would have been openable, and he was standing inside. People were probably in the house, outside the house, could hear him preach. These were always large groups. And whatever it took, I want to be there, and they hung around to hear him preach. So he's up this stairway halfway, because unless there was a stairway outside, I doubt that. Could have been, but not here. So he's on the stair halfway up. He had a candle in his hand, preaching Christ, and he carried it until the candle had burned itself out, which is interesting. It actually went out. So Parsons then took him up to his room, and we must be midnight at this time, where he had a short conversation. They read scripture, and it was mentioned that Isaac Watts' hymn book by his side, and they had been somewhat at loggerheads, but they had come around to be friends. I think Watts was kind of critical of Whitfield for a while, but in the end not. And he retired. So the time was late in the evening or early in the morning. Nothing said about that time. Whitfield again seemed short of breath, which if you read his trips over, we go back 10 years and he talks about the shortness of breath then already. And the way he talks, like he was going to die then, his bark is frail, you know, ship is frail, he's going to die. So you keep thinking he's going to die, and then look at the date. No, he's got 10 years to go yet. So he was a reflexive, resilient person, even though he says he had asthma. I don't know how they would diagnose him today, but the shortness of breath would certainly be the opposite of what you need if you're going to go out and preach. So Whitfield again seemed short of breath, asked for an open window to be opened wider. He said because of asthma, his asthma was returning. Whitfield was told that he should not preach so much. to which he responded by saying he would rather wear out than rust out. I wondered if he made that up or whether he picked that up from somewhere, because it's an expression we have used, right? So around 5 o'clock in the morning, Mr. Whitfield walked over to the window to gain his breath, but could not without difficulty. Now, it was clear to Whitfield at this point that he was in the struggle for air, that he was dying. A doctor was called to attend him, agreed that to that assessment. And it was 6 a.m. in the morning that the lungs of the great orator who depended on them as a great preacher to thousands took their last breath. 1 hour of attempts to revive him failed, so it was that on September 30, 1770, that the mighty Whitfield made his last voyage, this time to his true home. And he was only 55 three-quarters years old. Another irony here is Whitfield had made arrangements that if he died in the colonies, that he wanted to be buried at Newburyport. There he was, in the Presbyterian Church. So he was laid in the crypt of the church, eventually that Pastor Jonathan Parsons was buried next to him. I haven't imagined that that manse is still standing there, because that picture we see here is a modern picture. And I see on the web, people have gone there and taken pictures of it. All right, so some of you know J.C. Ryle. I know you've just been reading Ryle. This is what he said about Whitfield. He said, Whitfield wrote no book for the millions of worldwide fame like Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. He headed no crusade against an apostate church with the nation at his back and the princes on his side like Martin Luther. He founded a religious denomination which pinned his faith on his writings and carefully embalmed his best acts and words like John Wesley. There are Lutherans and there are Wesleyans in the present day, but there are no Whitfieldites. No, the great evangelist of the 18th century was a simple, guileless man who lived for one thing only, and that was to preach Christ. If he did that, he cared for nothing less. Bishop Ryle, 1868. Well, it's interesting that on this day, we have the news that Billy Graham died, and the day that we were going to study Whitfield's death. I didn't count the years difference, but there would be a few. And we have Cliff Sparrows, Bevachet, where the people that were on the platform with them. We participated in the crusade in Omaha in 1960. We sang in the choir, and we were part of the follow-up team, as they make, you know, to counsel people that came forward, and I'll talk about that when I get to it, but that was our experience with them. So this about Mr. Graham. There will be a comparison made amongst evangelists in America, no doubt, between these two guys. They should, at least. But the scope of Graham's ministry via the radio and the television ministry would have outstripped the horse and buggy ministry of George Whitfield, I don't know how many times. But there were similarities. Graham preached to a variety of church memberships with diverse theologies, which, as did Whitfield, who attempted to be a peacemaker rather than a defender of an island. That did not mean he stood for nothing. In fact, just the opposite. It just meant that he could allow others, their consciences, to be respected. So it is on this note that some of us have been critical of the softness of Graham's theological position, especially in his later years. Again, we'll elaborate on that later. But age has a softening effect on youthful rhetoric. Of course, he was not a church planter, where these luxuries of divergent opinion cannot exist in harmony. When you're a church planter, you can't be very loose. And your evangelist, quite. And I've mentioned this to you about evangelist gifts. Those people tend not to be theologians. Can't live in both houses at the same time. On that basis, Graham's churches would not have been solidly biblical, I don't believe. And I told you about his influence from Nelson Bell, his covenant, and that turned him away from fundamentalism, and that would have weakened his stance on the word and weakened his stance on the church and weakened his life at the end. We'll talk about that. But Graham was not called to be a church planter or planting. He didn't plant churches. Here's where Graham and Whitfield share a common gift. They were evangelists. Whitfield ended strong as a youthful evangelist. 55, youthful, right? Graham as a fully matured and seasoned one. And we must remember that, according to Romans 14:4, that as we look at these two men to their master, each of them will stand. And the encouraging word to me is that he will stand. And the Lord makes sure that he will. So we will deal with Graham in a detail in the later series. We will deal with the influence of the Presbyterian theology being covenantal. which directed Graham away from fundamentalist theology. However, this made a partnership with liberalism, which I don't know what other word to use there, which may not have been otherwise possible. And I put a question mark there. Is that how God does things? Well, he does a lot of things we don't expect, so maybe this is one of those things you might have to think a little bit, because when Graham went to make partnership with a lot of people in New York City in this crusade in 1950, he lost a lot of friends. But on the other hand, it opened the doors for a lot of other people that would not have come to a fundamentalist place. We maybe could think about that. Again, we must reserve judgment to the Lord of the church who calls his workers into the harvest. While we would have them all be like us, it is surely true that some of the work then would not get done. So we give thanks for the ministry of Billy Graham and pray for his son Franklin, who I think is a stronger apologetic person than his father. So pray for his son Franklin to continue the work of aggressive evangelism.